Hi, it's Patrick Cox here.
And Nina Porzuki. This is The World in Words.
We are taking a break this week from Donald Trump.
Yeah, no more Trump. Yeah, in fact, in this episode and the next one, we are going to spend time in the company of people who speak or study dialects. Particular dialects. Dialects associated with certain religions. So, Patrick, if I were to ask you, for example, to name one Jewish language or dialect, what would it be?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is Yiddish,
right?
Oh,
well, of course. No-brainer.
Okay.
Everybody knows a bit of Yiddish. Alternatively, I also think of Sephardi, the Spanish language.
Yeah, you see, you're just being highfalutin there. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But Yiddish is a dialect spoken by Ashkenazi Jews based on centuries-old version of German.
Even a goy like me...
A goy like you.
...throws in the old putz into his conversation. And you taught me the word Dafka, Nina.
Oh, yeah. That is actually the very first story that we worked on together.
And we still need to do that, you know, how we met episode in the podcast sometime.
Yeah, how I got my start in radio. Anyway, we're not going to talk schmutz or bubkis or verkackt today.
It sounds so much better when you say those things,
Nina. Well... You gotta just, like, channel your own, Woody Allen. Instead, this week, we are going to talk about a dialect that predates it all, and it is every bit as associated with Judaism, though it is hardly spoken anymore. However, our intrepid colleague Alina Simone found some speakers in, of all places, Canada.
Tucked into a residential section of Montreal's Côte des Neiges neighborhood, there's a prominent building that could be mistaken for a bank. Loads of glass, stainless steel, heavy security. Actually, it's a synagogue. And despite the modern makeover, it's home to Canada's oldest Jewish congregation, dating back to the very first settlers who arrived in Quebec in the 1760s. It's called the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue, but you're just as likely to hear a version of Arabic spoken inside. Lizette Shashua, Gladys Catan, and Elsie Solomon are friends who grew up together in Baghdad, but left more than 40 years ago, part of a near-total exodus of Jews from the region. This is Judeo-Arabic. They speak the Iraqi variant of it. Even though it's their mother tongue, it was only after they left Iraq that they began to understand where the words they spoke really came from.
There were a lot of Turkish and Persian words, and Indian words.
And Hebrew words.
And our dialect. We didn't realize that these were not Arabic words. It's only later that we realized some of the words were Hebrew. When we were in Israel and we said, oh, it's the same word you're using. No, it's a Hebrew word.
I'm a social linguist, so I'm interested in language variation.
This is Benjamin Hari, professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU. He describes Judeo-Arabic not as a dialect, but as a religiolect, a language variety spoken by a religious community. A religiolect?
A good example is Jewish English. So, and that would be a religiolect, right? This is the dialect or the language variety that Jews have been speaking and developing in the United States, for example, but also in the UK and in Australia, in South Africa and in other places, where they have elements from mostly Yiddish, but also from Hebrew. And they mix these elements within the English. So it could be in the lexicon, like Daven, to pray, or Shul, which is a synagogue. But it also could be in the grammar. So I was bar mitzvahed in Los Angeles.
Judeo-Arabic is a form of Arabic, with borrowings from Aramaic, as well as the languages of various countries Jews migrated through over the centuries. But how has it managed to remain distinct?
There's always issues in the Jewish community not to assimilate. So when you come to a new place, or when you have new rulers, you adopt the language, but you're worried that you'll assimilate too much. So unconsciously, clearly, they dress the language with Jewish features.
Like using Hebrew script. Judeo-Arabic differs depending on the region, from Iraq to Morocco. But broadly speaking, it was the lingua franca of the medieval Jewish world. Consider this. 800 years ago, 90% of the world's Jews spoke Arabic as their native language.
There were more Jews living under Islam than under Christianity at that time. So that it's not surprising that Judeo-Arabic or Arabic, you could say in general, is a very Jewish language. We have amazing number of thinkers, intellectual thinkers, who wrote in Judeo-Arabic, all the way from Saadia Gaon to Yehuda Halevi and Maimonides. Maimonides was the greatest philosopher and doctor and physician and thinker and a law person and a scientist. He was all of these things. And he wrote in Judeo-Arabic. He also wrote in Arabic.
But the expulsion of Jews from Middle Eastern countries over the past 70 years now threatens to drive one of the oldest known Jewish languages to extinction within a generation or two. Take Iraq. Prior to 1950, it was home to as many as 150,000 Jews. Today, it's estimated fewer than 5 remain. It's hard for me to imagine a time when Jews were thriving there or what life in Jewish Baghdad was even like. So I asked Lizette to see some photos.
Yeah, somebody took pictures. Oh, yeah. Okay. This is me at age 9, having a candy cigarette, pretending it's a cigarette.
It was as a child that Lizette first began to notice things were going wrong in Iraq.
In 1958, when the king was killed, then the guy who killed the king was killed 4 years later, and then the guy that killed him got killed. It's like, you know, coup d'etats, one after the other. It got to a stage when you hear boom, boom, boom. You say, oh, we don't go to school today. There's a revolution. Like it became a way of life.
Things had been getting worse for Jews even before Lizette and her friends were born. In 1948, when Israel was established, Iraq made Zionism a capital crime and began forcing Jews who left the country to give up all their property. Anti-Jewish sentiment spiked throughout the Middle East. Here's archival audio of King Faisal of Saudi Arabia.
We believe that all disturbances in our area have originated after the unjustified creation of Israel.
For 4 years, we were kind of under house arrest.
Gladys Catan is talking about her last years in Baghdad. She left in 1971.
They cut our telephone service. We were not allowed to work. We were not allowed to go to university. We were not allowed to meet together as friends. So therefore, you can't go to a coffee shop and meet with your friends. So we're literally under house arrest.
Outside of their homes, speaking Judeo-Arabic became dangerous. The girls had to disguise themselves, linguistically. Here's Lizette again.
In the street, we started to speak Muslim to each other so that they don't know that we are Jewish.
Muslim, meaning the version of Arabic the Iraqi Muslims spoke.
You see, the Muslim dialect was, and the Christian and the Jewish, they were each different from each other, and you could tell when you hear somebody talk.
The dialects were distinguishable, but not mutually intelligible, to everyone, that is.
Now, it's interesting that the Jews and the Christians understood the Muslims, but not vice versa. But this is very common to majority-minority relationships. So when you're a minority, you need to understand the majority dialect because you need to do commerce, you need to do many things with the majority. But vice versa, not necessarily.
When Elsie Solomon fled Baghdad, her family took a perilous route through northern Iraq into Iran. They crossed the mountains on foot and by mule, led by Kurdish guides who made it clear there was no time for self-pity.
And we started talking, you know, how cold it is, how bad it is. And they said, look at the lights there. If they hear you, they're going to shoot you.
All three of the women I spoke to in Montreal, all of them, assumed that once they were out of Iraq, they could finally cast off their disguises and, you know, just be themselves. But they found themselves stigmatized from an unlikely source, other Jews. The Ashkenazi, whose ancestors came from Eastern Europe, held themselves apart. And wherever the three women landed, be it Jerusalem or Montreal, they felt tension.
That it's the Ashkenazi Jews that came first, and we were just we were embarrassed. Like
second-class
citizens. We were embarrassed. Like, I would apologize for being, you know, from the Middle East.
Things are better now within the Jewish community, but the stigma of speaking Arabic still lingers.
Unfortunately, you'll try it even in New York. If you speak loud in Arabic at a restaurant, people will look at you. People are scared. It's crazy, but this is the situation. So in Israel, you know, you identify Arabic, unfortunately, as the language of the enemy. And a lot of my work is to convince the Israeli public that it's Jewish language. It's not the language of the enemy. It's crazy. It may be the language of our neighbors, but it's not the language of the enemy. You can't treat the language that way.
Now, with much of the Jewish Arabic-speaking population dispersed, the fate of the language rests with the diaspora. But as is usually the case, the children of these immigrants just want to fit in. In Montreal,
they are speaking English or French in school, and they want to be understood by their friends. They didn't particularly want to learn an Iraqi Jewish dialect.
It was embarrassing. It was even unthought of for us to teach the kids Arabic. It was like those beautiful kids speaking this guttural sounding language. I mean, you know, you kind of say, no, you want to teach them English. You want them to become modern, cosmopolitan. I mean, this was, for us, a dead language.
3 years ago, a feature film about the Jewish exodus from Iraq was released. It was called Farewell Baghdad. It was the first film ever made in Judeo-Arabic, and yet the actors, mostly children of Iraqi Jews, actually had to learn how to speak it. But there's a growing effort to preserve the language. Lizette tells me one of their old schoolmates who now lives in Israel recently started teaching a class. And a couple of years ago, an online archive called Sephardi Voices was launched, featuring interviews with Judeo-Arabic speakers, as well as rare recordings like this one, of the last prayer service held in Iraq sometime in the 1990s. And 6,000 miles from Baghdad, for members of a certain generation, Judeo-Arabic lives on in the living rooms of Montreal.
She's asking me, what did you cook today? I said, no, I didn't cook. I don't cook on Saturday. I don't cook, barely anyway. But I am dying for a tea.
Alina Simone is a reporter and writer who contributes frequently to The World in Words. So, Nina.
Yeah?
When I say tripod, what do you think?
I think, try listening to a podcast. That's what I think.
I do that all the time. I'm obsessed with podcasts. I don't need to try listening. I already do it.
But you know that statistic, Patrick, that only about 1 in 5 Americans actually do listen to podcasts. Well, all you people out there.
There's a bit of preaching to the converted.
Right,
here,
exactly.
Right? Still, we need to do something about this. All of us together, we need to get the word out to whoever's not listening
to the world.
Right? There are podcasts about just about everything and for everyone.
I think that's the best part about podcasts, actually. So lately I have been listening to, well, I always listen to The Gist with Mike Pesca because he's a maniac.
He is. You can't stop him.
You can't stop him. And I like listening to the absurd workings of his mind. And I've been listening to Andrea Salenzi's YOY, which is another Slate podcast. And then finally, you know, there was that onslaught of podcasts about the election, and I've continued to listen to, it has a new name now, but it's called Pod Save America. Very popular podcast.
Yeah.
How about you?
Along the same lines, I've been listening to Slate's Trumpcast, which started before the election, nearly ended, but because of the election, it has continued. Also one called Maeve in America.
That was a good one.
Irish woman, young Irish woman who is in the United States and does immigration. A lot of fun. And then one which I can't say is a lot of fun, but is a great listen. It's called The Untold. There's a mini series on it right now. It's just finished, which is about a man who walked out on his family and his wife's attempts to track him down. It's a great list.
Wow. Who produces that one?
I think it's a BBC.
Is it fiction or real life?
No, it's real life. And I think it's a BBC production, but it's not something that was on the radio. It's a specific
podcast first.
Podcast first thing, yeah.
Trypod, hashtag TRYPOD.
We'll post all of our pod recommendations as part of that. We'll give it the hashtag and all of that. And please do the same thing. And more important than that, perhaps, tell people around you that podcasts are cool.
So cool.
Super easy to listen to.
If your mom, and let's not be ageist here, or your younger brother who doesn't know how to get a podcast, take out their phone and subscribe them to The World in Words, first of all. And then some other good podcasts.
You know what they said, the people who were organizing the tripod thing? They were like, you know, you may have to train the hosts to not keep pushing their own podcast.
Really?
Anyway, just enable your friends, enable your mom, enable your younger brother. I'm enabling my mom because, let's face it, she enabled me for most of my life. Okay, Nina, you know that we have in our midst here in the newsroom of PRI's The World, we have a novelist.
Well, we probably have a dozen would-be novelists, but I think I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah, her name is Louie Cronin. And by day, she runs the boards in our studios, but by night, she writes. And she's published a really delightful novel. It came out a few months ago. It's called Everyone Loves You Back. It's set in Cambridge, Massachusetts, home, of course, to Harvard and MIT. And I was in the middle of reading it. And what should I find but this little episode with a couple of linguistics professors? And it's really funny. So I knew that I had to ask Louie to come in and read it.
Okay, so set it up. Who are we going to hear from?
Well, this is two couples at a restaurant. There's the central character. His name is Bob. He works in radio. He produces a daily call-in show with guests. He's at the restaurant with his girlfriend, Leonie, and he's meeting these two friends of Leonie's. They're also a couple, and they're the linguistics professors. They're called Gary and Martha. Here's Louie reading from the book.
Gary orders a California Cabernet Sauvignon. Martha asks for a cranberry and soda and the appetizer menu. So, Bob, we hear you're producing a new talk show? Yeah, but we only just started, he says. It's kind of the blind leading the blind at this point. Leonie shakes her head. Bob, you're so self-deprecating. He covers her hand with his. No, really, he says. Well, Martha and I both have books coming out this year if you're ever desperate for guests. Oh, really? What are they about? Gary looks to Martha. You first, he says. Mine is about gender divergence in psycholinguistic patterning in the sadomasochistic bondage and discipline community. Sounds interesting. Bob looks down at his appetizer menu to suppress a laugh. And is there a divergence? Leonie asks. Well, it's hard to summarize it neatly, but men tend to use language, or the lack thereof, for example, with the use of gags and other bondage paraphernalia, as an erotic toy, whereas women use it more to communicate commands. In other words, Gary says, women talk more. Leonie and Bob both laugh. Martha hits Gary on the arm, but she is also laughing. And how did you do your research? Bob asks. Mostly online chat rooms, Martha says, and, she colors slightly, some field work. The sacrifices we linguists make, Gary says. Bob looks at him more closely. He would prefer he did not have a sense of humor. And is it the same for gay and straight people? Leonie asks. Ha! Martha points her finger at Leonie. Great question. That's my next book. Bob looks at Gary. Does he see a hint of a smirk on his face? And yours? What's yours about? Nowhere near as sexy, I'm afraid. Gary bows his head in a show of humility. I explore the development of neurolinguistic pathways in religious fundamentalists. Oh, that is sexy, Leonie says. Have you ever listened to a religious fundamentalist? Gary says. We're not talking complex thought here or sentence structure. Their neural pathways are like well-worn, rutted roads. They always end up in the same place. My neural pathways are probably more like rotaries, Bob says. Round and round, can't decide where to get off.
That's fantastic. I got to ask you, did the particular disciplines, or did the particular topics that this husband and wife linguist team had chosen for their books, were they based on anything you'd ever come across, any kind of research that you'd ever noticed on, I don't know, some, you know, Harvard website or something?
No, really. Most of all, I made it up. I really just made it up. The thing about fundamentalists having less complicated neural pathways, I had actually heard my sister was a proofreader for an academic article about that. So she had told me about that there was some research on that. But the other thing I noticed, like when I went to grad school, whenever they could throw in sex, they would. So, you know, in bondage and it, like, there always had to be something, like, you said it with a straight face, but you were talking about sadomasochism or something thrown into, you know, linguistics. So
as if linguistics wasn't sexy enough.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the other thing is, why did you choose linguists? I mean, they could have come from any academic discipline.
Yeah.
Why linguistics?
I mean, it's a good question. And maybe I wanted something I could be sort of interested in, something that I'd like.
So you're telling me that you wouldn't actually mind writing a book on these subjects, or maybe right, different subjects associated with linguistics.
Different subjects. Yeah. No, I always was interested in linguistics and always thought about studying it. So maybe that's part of it. And then, you know, I mean, I did get a graduate degree in writing. So, I mean, there was always a little bit of that kind of theory in maybe not the same, though. I mean, literary theory is really different, so.
Right, right. Well, I'm very glad that you put it in, and I'm very glad you read your wonderful book, which I can't recommend highly enough. It's great fun. Louis Cronin. Her novel's called Everyone Loves You Back, available in all good bookstores, on all good internets. Speaking of the internet, we have an internet, as my dad used to say. Actually, it was more like, do you have a web? Our internet is pri.org/language, where you can see pictures of the Judeo-Arabic speakers that Alina Simone spoke with. Also, we have a Facebook, and we have a Twitter. It's called LingoPod. And finally, we have a podcast, which we would love you to review wherever you listen, just so the word spreads and more people get a chance to listen. And remember, tripod, hashtag TRYPOD. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in the next episode with this.
Christianese is the language with which Christians speak. It is nuanced and cryptic and almost entirely unnecessary.